First thing is to really to explain why I'm here. And it took some time for me to figure out why I'm here. And I think it's the health and culture is something probably the more, the apparently more distant of the other two themes from the GPP discussion, which has been driven through arts and humanities, in fact. And here we have somebody from science trying to make a point of interest to you. The first thing that came to my mind, what does science and medicine is characterized by? So I've just listed the four things, so the pillars, concepts in science and medicine. Innovation. Obviously, we are driven by the need to innovate, to bring new drugs, new therapies, do new diagnostics, to discover new substances. So it's a forward-looking discipline, very much. But obviously, it wouldn't be quite successful just to look forward without knowing what is our past in science and medicine. And very often in some areas, we tend to reinvent the wheel, for instance. So I thought valuing the past in our science and medicine is a very, very important issue, and in a different way. So history of medicine is a very, very important background knowledge we need to carry with us. The second point is generalizability. Everything we do should apply to all. You discover a new medicine, you should treat the same disease in everyone. It doesn't matter just starting for one individual. So you want to make sure it's generalizable. And yet we're facing every day with the point that some people respond to drugs, some others don't. Men and women act differently. Old and young. Ethnic groups have different behaviors. So again, the concept of culture, in the widest sense, comes into play in understanding medicine. The other point that we look at is in the individual versus the collectivity. I do epidemiology, which is the interest of the health of populations. But I'm also a physician, so I treat people, individuals. There always this contrast, dichotomy between treating an individual, so taking care of behavior, beliefs, individual positions, and also try to make some decisions in policy of healthcare which would enrich the majority, so the collectivity. And that brings into play the socioeconomic background, the political environment, and so forth, which I think I cluster into culture. And finally, the difference is very technical between efficacy and effectiveness. And very few people in the audience will understand what I mean. But in reality, when you discover a new drug, and you do a clinical trial in a small group of people, and you prove that that drug works, it's not the end of it. Then you extend it to your population. You go everywhere. So you do your trial, you treat people in Italy, you treat people in England, in Africa, and then you find that sometimes that treatment works, sometimes does not work. And that is effectiveness. Does it work in that particular setting? So the milieu in which the population lives and thrives is a factor which interacts with the efficacy of therapies. So I went through these principles and tried to see how I can convey to you what I see is the interconnection between health and culture, and take culture as the widest possible bag of content in it. Now, this is one of the paradigm of medicine and science. On the right-hand side, we study health and disease. These are the terminology in science, which is the combination of genetic influences on the right-hand side, linked to the environmental influences and some gene-environment interaction, which leads to health and disease. But if we go in a wider context, we should talk really about well-being and ill health rather than health and disease. And what I wanted to address today and give you a couple of examples so that we can open up the discussion later on is what we can fill this environment with. On genes, we can't change them, and they are no interest to us. There are no cultural genes. There are genes. Okay, we can do some historical tracking of genes. There's very little we can do on them at the moment. What we can do is to change the environment in which we live, which influences our ill health or well-being. So on the other hand, environmental factors in a cultural sense could be just beyond the one we consider in medicine. And just list some. I think about the social domain, for instance. As I say, history is important. The gender issues are important. The economics is important. I'll give you one example. And the politics is very important in how health and health policy or health healthcare delivery impacts on the continuation well-being or the prevention of ill health. But also the art domain fascinates me a lot. I've done a lot of reading in my own field. And literature, theater, painting, music, add on any others, offer continuous cues about the progression of medicine and science in history, which we should not forget and we should treasure. And the cultural domain also is absolutely vital, particularly in long-term conditions, or in some conditions where beliefs, behaviors, religion, for instance, do play a very important role. And I want to give you a couple of examples in my areas of research where we can look at some of these provocative links. And one is the area of nutrition and health, and the other one would be the role of sleep in relation to health. And very briefly, I just want to, for instance, take you this idea of high salt intake and ill health. High salt causes high blood pressure causes your stroke. You reduce your salt, you prevent your strokes, and you get better. And it's also been shown that if for every dollar you spend in reducing salt, you have a return of $6 to $12. Health economics in it. Well, that would be good enough to change behavioral culture in terms of nutrition. But what stands in our way is something else, which obviously needs you to look beyond medicine, absolutely, to understand why this is not working yet, that we make people reduce salt intake. And very briefly, this is what I call the cycle of profit. Don't go into great detail. But these are three levels, the A, B, and C circles, by which the food industry, the beverage industry, makes a lot of money out of all of us eating salt. And there will be no interest at all in reducing salt. That could bridge with food security, in fact, very much. So they make you thirsty, so you sell more soft drinks, put salt in your meat, so it gets more water and you pay the water, the cost of meat. Or, yes, you can become addictive because they train you to like salt. All these things make impossible and healthcare provision quite difficult unless you bridge into other disciplines. Now, obesity is another problem. I go back to history. In Venus, sign of beauty, fertility, was really quite a plumpy woman, wasn't it? And there was also fertility. And we're talking about 20,000 BC, but this is the same Venus seen by Titian, and still quite plumpy. And this is the beauty of the time, which is obviously beauty linked to health, and in a sense in culture and other things to fertility. And we don't have to go too far back. Still, Fernando Botero, still living today, portrayed the Venus in a sort of picture like this. But what is the actual health and the body size relationship we have now, as we know from medicine, is nothing like that, but not even nothing like the other side, that is what is the current domain in which beauty is probably seen as the other excess. Now, what is the cultural domain that is driving across history? What has nothing to do with health? And we know health is something else. So I'm very puzzled by these things, so we need to study. And another area which is very close to my heart, in fact, is I come from Naples originally. This is a Mediterranean country. Some of you will recognize on the left-hand side one typical terracotta portrait from the crib, the presepio, the one of the typical Neapolitan crib you have at Christmas time, very artistic sometimes, and developed very much in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. Now, as you can see, one of the portraits is the fruit and vegetable there, and I'm sure all of you think that Mediterranean diet is good for you, isn't it? That is a given. Now, who introduced the Mediterranean diet concept to around the world was a guy called Ansel Keys, an American who happened to travel in the southern Mediterranean parts of Italy, south of Naples, in fact, in the Cilento region. And he studied the local people, and they were living up to 1900. And in the 50s and 60s, he described what would be the Mediterranean diet, because all the people were very healthy. Now, that has led to a stereotyping of Mediterranean people and culture, by which all the Mediterraneans are healthy because they eat a Mediterranean diet. I'm sure some of you still believe that is the case. And I can tell you that's untrue. And it's untrue not today. It was untrue in the 60s. Now, I take from my Neapolitan background one of the playwrights, Eduardo De Filippo, very famous in Naples around the world. And this is one of the plays where a breakfast is displayed in three different characters in the play. The Generino and Geraldina. These are well-looked-after children of Antonio Baracano, who's the boss, a self-made boss. And they have two eggs and coffee and milk, which in the 60s, this was produced in 1960, was quite a rich breakfast for the time. So indicating some sort of social status, food really was a link to social status. On the other hand, the workman Cattiello is having the same breakfast at the same time—a breakfast of pasta with beans left over from the day before. Obviously, that's really quite a manual social class relation in terms of. And the same Antonio Baracano, the boss, reflects his humble origin by looking at this breakfast, which is bread and milk, which is the very best breakfast for him. And this is revealing his humble origins. Now, at the time, not every Mediterranean was having a very healthy diet. And diet was, in fact, denotes social status and interlinks with other disciplines. That's what I want to highlight. Finally, a couple of examples on sleep. Now, in ancient classics, until very recently, sleep and death equate as the same thing. Now, you've got a few quotes there, starting from the Hesiod, 800 BC, moving down to the Odyssey of Homer, Virgil, and then down to Shakespeare. In all these, sleep equates with death. And it was assumed that sleep was a deadly state. So in reality, culturally, you would assume that the less sleep you had, the better you were. You were more distant from death. And then we come to what we have also contributed in part two, to these recent research from our research programs. One is our book, and one is Simon Williams' book from the sociology department. Warwick is a high contributor to this new area, where now, sleep is obviously understood as a very important, active, vital state of the brain to recover. And that reducing sleep contributes to ill health. So you see how much now there is a cultural shift, and this is reflected in many societies where these sort of concepts are not taken yet, so there is still more of a belief of sleep as a deadly situation rather than a sleep as a necessary function. You see, this is some of the sleeping hours in the different populations around the world. Just to highlight that those who sleep less than 6 hours or 7 hours do report more ill health. And these are all countries in the Far East, Asia. Now, why are they sleeping less? And as a consequence, they're suffering more ill health as a result of sleep deprivation. We don't know very much, but definitely there must be societal influences in these groups that lead to a curtailment of their sleep, either for cultural, for necessities, for the 24/7 society. There must be more tolerance in those societies on the curtailment of sleep compared to other societies where sleep is protected. And as you go around the world, you will see that not all people sleep the same way. We have three types of sleeping cultures: the monophasic sleep culture, the one that we tend to observe, the one slot of 8 hours per night; the biphasic sleep, which is the siesta cultures, when you have breaks; and the polyphasic sleep pattern, which is the napping culture, very much developing in Japan, China, and other Eastern countries. So I conclude by inviting you to consider the cultural dimensions of health and health policies with domains even beyond the one that I've just hinted to you, with the view to create a bridge between science and cultures. And cultures are in italics, because by then I mean anything you want to put in the bag of culture, as I tried to define. There will be a reciprocal enrichment. It's not one direction only. Science will enrich humanities, humanity will enrich science in this not debate, but colloquium between the two large disciplines. And also will open up opportunities for what I call cross-disciplinary or interdisciplinary research. And those two questions, the one I put to you in the group of health and culture, and we will address it later. Thank you.